Hey everybody, Dave Hodges here, host of The Common Sense Show, and you know, we're the show that's known as Freeing America One Enslaved Mind at a Time, but we need your help. A lot of our broadcasts, you know, on digital, we go podcast, we're on three networks, archives you can access. So, hey, when you hear a guest, you go, hey, this is really important stuff, and I think this is going to be one of these interviews. We need you to share these far and wide. We need to wake up America. And really, America is waking up. Joe Biden's done more for our movement than I could have done in 20 years, but we need to help people understand how it all fits together. And that's why I think sending these broadcasts out is important, and I appreciate your help in that area. And you guys are just a great audience, and thanks for joining us. And you all know Sarah Westall. You heard her yesterday on our show as we talked about the importance of getting Tom Rentz, the frontline doctor's attorney, on more shows. And Sarah recommended that I talk to a lady named Susan Bradford. And Susan has sent me some of her materials, and I've just had a cursory look at some of them, and it's really good. And you're going to think in some ways you're talking to me, but Susan does something that I don't do a lot. She has deep historical documentation that helps you understand the foundations of what's happening today. And it's phenomenal stuff. I've looked through the completeness is incredible, exquisite detail. And Susan and I are going to do a number of interviews on these topics. And today we're just going to kind of introduce the topic and where we're going, and we're just going to go from there. And then we'll have Susan back, and we'll do more highlighted, targeted coverage of specific points on here. China will be a central theme, and you go, oh, Dave, that's right up your alley. Yes, it is. Thank you very much. You know my position on China in our election. So this is going to be good, folks. Susan, I want to welcome you to the show. First time guest, thanks to our mutual friend, Sarah Westall, who's just tremendous. And she highly recommended you. I got to tell you, she doesn't do that very often, but she gave you the highest recommendation.
Well, thank you so much, and I think you're very highly of Sarah as well, and I'm really delighted to be here. I appreciate the work that you do.
Thank you. Sarah, before we get into what we were talking about in our pre-air discussion, tell the people a little bit about your background.
Sure. I'm originally from California, where I planned to embark upon a career in journalism. And as I was working in Los Angeles for, you know, CBS News and also for City News Service covering the O.J. Simpson trial, I decided that I wanted to focus more on international relations. So after I earned my bachelor's, I went over to England to earn a master's in international relations from the University of Essex. And while I was working there, I was able to get access to some of the corridors of power within London. I worked for the Atlantic Council of the UK. I established a journal for the Center for European Studies at Essex, in which I was able to solicit and edit manuscripts from leading heads of state on globalism, European integration, the Atlantic Alliance. And I was even able to secure an interview with Baron Robert Rothschild, one of the architects of the European Union. And so from there, with that background, I wanted to learn more about, you know, what type of global system they were creating. Still at that point, I didn't know how malevolent it was, but I was very intrigued. I returned to the United States around the time that 9/11 broke, and news bureaus were closing around the world. They were scaling back. After I worked for Fox News Channel and Voice of America, and then I embarked upon working on a project working on the Abramoff investigation. And if you recall, Jack Abramoff was one of the leading lobbyists for the Bush administration. His influence was, you know, throughout the entire federal bureaucracy, vast. And as I began to research the background of his case, I discovered how the deep state had been projected and established through the back doors of America's federal Indian tribes. And from there, I was able to piece together how the entire deep state was established in the United States. And I have been trying to alert the public ever since, and I've been, you know, covering different aspects of the deep state through my books.
Oh my, I just, you just took the air out of my lungs. I have a very good friend, colleague, Paul Preston, who's the head of the California 51st State Movement and has the very popular show, Gen 21 Radio. Anyway, Susan, we're getting some background noise there on your end. Okay, I think that's better. Okay, anyway. But Paul, very much into the Jesuits, influence in California, very much into the cartel influence on native land, and how they support the deep state. I bet that rings a bell with you.
Yes, it does.
Paul and I have had many discussions. We've done some interviews on that as well, too. But anyway, that's really interesting, and you hit something else. I'm going to make a revelation here, Susan. You almost get to interview me here on this one point. My dad was naval intel, and going back in time, they things like father, like son. So I was heavily recruited to go to the Naval Academy, and the Vietnam War was still going on, hadn't quite ended yet. And my dad said, no way in hell is he going to this. And he blocked it, cut off communication between me and Gary Hart, who was our senator at the time. And they put the full court press on me to go. I'd even gone and taken my, you have to do these physical exams and so forth. And I'd done all that. And my dad stepped in and says, no, not doing it. I know what they're going to do with you. And he says, I want you to have a normal life and not kind of the life I had where I was home infrequently. So that got blocked, but they don't give up on you. And here's what I mean. I got approached to be in an investment group just out of the blue with someone who had known my father. And I knew the name, and it was Tommy Buckley Greenlight Group. And we did pretty well money-wise. And at that time, I was a high school teacher and a coach, and kind of out of place for me to be in this. And they said, well, we want you to take a little time off. We have some work we want you to do for us. Now, the timing was the very early 90s, or late 80s, early 90s. And I did this for a couple of years. And what I did was I made presentations throughout Europe, and I had the old diplomatic pouch and didn't have to go through customs and stuff. And I would fly out and I would do a lot of stuff where I'd present why your bank should want to monetize with the euro, and a way to put pressure on national governments to get them to do the same thing, because, you know, they had to equalize the currencies.
Correct.
And I've never revealed this before, that I did this work. This is the first time. I was under a non-disclosure agreement until 2013, and I just didn't think it was wise for me to talk about it, but I'm thinking all that's going on right now in the world. Well, I left, and you talked about corruption. There was a French banker, and I'm not going to say his name here because I don't need the after effect attention. But there was a French banker who owned five banks. And this lady from Portland named Sherry was one of my partner at the time. And we would do these joint presentations. And we knew the family well. He was not cooperative with the process. He just said, I'll shut my banks down before we do this. I'll go international, blah, blah, blah. I'll go offshore. And he was very vocal. Very difficult. He talked to the media, and you know, with these people, you don't do that. Well, they found the entire family, including the children, strangled to death with piano cord at their vacation home on the French Riviera. And Sherry and I both went to who we reported to in London and said, we're done with this. We're not having any part of this. See, I saw nothing wrong with the creation of a euro, but I was naive then. I wasn't aware of the New World Order stuff. I saw this as the normal course of financial transaction, and it was sold to us like, this is a very normal thing. We're blending stock markets. We all do arbitrages together. And so, this is how they justified it. So I said, okay, I can go make these presentations. It's ethical. And gosh, we have heads of state involved, and I actually met a couple. And so that was my involvement in what you're talking about.
That's very interesting. The European Union was marketed as a regional common market upon which other regional markets would be based, like NAFTA, among others. And this was billed as a way to promote free trade, and
exactly,
everybody would prosper, but there's a hidden agenda behind this.
I was also told, too, that it was a way that they could bring a failed Soviet economy into the fold and not have to worry about them using their nuclear weapons out of desperation. And see, I thought this was a noble idea. because of things like that. I thought, this is a good idea. It's promoting world peace. And we'll do construction projects in Africa once we combine our currencies and we're stronger as a whole. And we'll eliminate, you know, people dying of drinking bad water. And so I thought of all these things. Little did I know they would just throw in with Bill Gates and let him wreck the whole thing. So isn't it funny how we've had a parallel path on the same topic?
It is. They've led us to, I guess, to a similar conclusion or the same conclusion about the events that are unfolding. They may not have told you that Wall Street bankrolled the communist revolution in Russia.
Yes. Yeah. They didn't tell me that, but I learned that as a matter of my work in what I do now. But the audience is going, whoa, Dave, were you a globalist? No, this wasn't globalism at the time. And Susan, I know you understand that. This was not about working through the UN and abrogating sovereign agreements. It was about getting control of banks. That's what it was about.
Control of the economies. They wanted to enmesh the countries into a series of interdependencies so that the individual nations would not be able to operate within their own self-interest.
Well, the other thing we were told, too, this is when Bosnia and that mess was going on there. And we had these terrible slaughters that were going on. And Susan, what they were telling us was, if we can do this, we can eliminate the Bosnias, all the uprisings that are going on. We can eliminate people massacring each other. And to me, it seemed like a very humanitarian thing to do. The only thing I thought, okay, if a guy doesn't want to put his bank in this, you're really going to make him? And that was something I had to admit, internally I struggled with. Did you ever have any dealings with that end of it, with the financial unification end of things from the banking standpoint?
I didn't work specifically with the banks. I do know that the elites dealt ruthlessly with anybody who expressed any opposition to their agenda.
When you say ruthlessly, so, what do you mean?
I mean that they have toppled leaders, they have assassinated people, they've staged revolutions. I mean, there are no lengths to which they will go to achieve their agenda.
Yeah, what years did you become aware of this?
I think I had always known about the New World Order since my youth, but I think I perceived it in maybe a very kind of a theoretical way that eventually the world would be united under a global superstructure. But I didn't really appreciate the nefariousness of the agenda until I worked on the Abramoff investigation. And from there, I saw that judges were bought off, that every decision on Capitol Hill has been influenced by a special interest, or that the Department of Justice has been entirely politicized, that the corporations essentially control the government, which no longer, you know, answers to we the people. So I began to understand that the entire system from the bottom, I guess from the top to the bottom, was corrupt.
Yeah, that, exactly. And it, like I said, it took me 2 years to see through it. I mean, 2 years of intense work. I had loose association with this for 4 years, but it took me the 2 years of this experience to say, everything is not quite as it appears. You know, I liken it to the movie The Firm. I don't know if you ever saw that with Tom Cruise. And The Firm was...
I read the book.
Yeah, well, so you have this professionally appearing law firm, okay? And they appear to be very, very good at what they do and very ethical. And then when you peel the covers back a little bit, you find out how unethical they are. And that's when I started making discoveries. And I said, I can't be part of this. This isn't just a business deal. That's why, you know, I was telling you before we went on the air and I was sharing this with Susan, how I got involved in this business. And most of my audience knows this. You know, John McCain came after us for the Canamex Highway and basically wanted to force us off our land without any compensation. And he had a long time to do it. We figured the build-out would have been about 20 to 25 years. And so they started by taking away our property rights and using a phony excuse of an Air Force base 30 miles away as being the excuse. We were in their way, and we knew that was a bunch of bull. And what we discovered in there was the North American Union, and that was the Canamex Highway. You know, started in Mexico City to extend to Edmonton, Alberta, and now they have actually building a leg of this between Wickenburg, Arizona, Vegas, on north. It's called I-11, brand new interstate highway for this purpose. Your tax dollars at work, folks, building internationalism. So when I was hit by these forces, I'd had enough experience in Europe that I said, no, I know exactly what I'm dealing with. And they got very uncomfortable with me. When I had my radio show, I got shot at when I was interviewing Jim Mars. And they attempted to run me off the road at one time. And the local sheriffs wouldn't do anything about it. So, Susan, been there, done that, and I discovered exactly what you're talking about. So let's, I tell you, look at this. I got to tell you, as many nice things as Sarah said about you, I think she undersold what you have here. And should we tell people, we had a hard time connecting this morning. And finally,
we did a lot of electronic.
Oh, yeah. We had a lot of electronic interference. Although that's happened with me and other guests, especially when I interview like Steve Quayle or Paul Preston. But nonetheless, we had major interference. Hey, I wanted to ask you about this publication you mentioned, the Atlantic Journal. Tell me about that.
The Atlantic Council, do you mean?
The Atlantic Council, right.
Okay, the Atlantic Council was the it's a NATO public affairs office. So they engage parliament, media, universities around Great Britain to advise them on foreign policy that would be in alignment with promoting the American Atlantic Alliance, which is the relationship between Great Britain and even Europe as well with the United States. Looking back, and I can see that it was essentially a propaganda outlet, but at the time it was, they drew upon credible academics and professors, along with heads of state, but most of them, of course, were influenced by special interests, so their opinion was bought.
I've been told it was like a reverse trilateral commission concept, where it tried to blend international interest into a think tank, and they would have their private knowledge, but they'd put out a public persona that was much different. Do you agree with that?
I think that could be true. I actually encountered a lot of individuals who I thought were very enlightened. Like, they treated globalism as a religion, or they believed that they could really achieve peace on earth and prosperity for all. So I think there were a lot of people who believed in the ideals or were convinced of them, and then there were like a private elites, like the bankers and like the Rothschilds, for example, who knew the wider agenda. Because I think the average person would not have gone along with the New World Order if they knew what was actually entailed with it.
Yeah, the reason I ask you about the Atlantic Council is because when Brexit was surfacing, and you remember, I'm kind of aware of some of the forces within Britain that are associated with the European Union and so forth, because I saw it. And I kept hearing about the Atlantic Council. And I kept thinking, okay, they're coming up in reference to Brexit, and they were trying to kill Brexit at every turn. And did you have any experience in following that at all, like the Atlantic Council getting in the way of this independence movement in Britain?
Well, I think there's a very strong Eurosceptic movement within Great Britain. They wanted to be separate from Europe and to retain London's position as like an offshore jurisdiction for European currency. But the Atlantic Council, as you correctly stated, was part of this wider trilateral movement. In fact, the director whom I worked with, Alan Lee Williams, was a member of the Trilateral Commission. So they wanted to bring Great Britain into the European Union to have all of the countries integrated into one larger common market that would then be controlled by the European bureaucracy.
That makes a lot of sense, the wider market. I think the origin of that, if I remember right, and I'm going to say this badly, but it was like the fuel and iron conglomeration from the 50s. I can't remember the exact name, but it was like hard mining interests and industry combining together to want to bring Europe into one nation.
Correct. It was called the European Coal and Steel Community.
That's it.
It was promoted by Avril Harrison, who was working with John Monnet, who was the the developer, I guess he conceived the notion, but really the European coal and steel community was an invention of the Rothschilds, and it was based upon the Mongolian guild system from Central Asia that enabled the Central Asian elites and merchant classes to establish monopolies.
Is this a Belt and Road part where we whip a little industry on you and some infrastructure, and then you're in debt and we own you?
That's correct. They establish relationships based upon dependency, specifically financial dependency.
Yeah, this became the Chinese foreign policy model, didn't it?
Yes, but this debt diplomacy originated in Central Asia.
Interesting.
So a lot of people don't know that.
But I know China's tried to do this. Well, the World Bank did it in Bolivia with their water. I covered that extensively when I got started in this business. But then we see China doing it in Ecuador, Chile, and really all over the world. They're doing it all through Africa right now so they can trade off putting military bases in Africa.
China aspires to have a Chinese century. They want to rule the world, and in order to seize the natural resources and land of other countries, they're offering to develop, you know, infrastructure and other, you know, maybe corporate and industrial enterprises within those countries, and then to place them in debt. Typically, they require natural assets, natural resources as collateral, and then once the country defaults on the loan, which they inevitably do, China then is able to seize control of those natural resources.
Right, and that idea came out of this very thing we were talking about with Atlantic Council interests and their subsequent business practices.
Correct.
Yeah,
correct.
I know. I began to see that in my final days. In fact, actually, nations were made to bend to the will of the European Union by doing exactly what we're talking about here. But this was Eurocentralized. This wasn't so much international as it was just basically Europe dealing with its European nations. It didn't want part of this. When you saw the
offer. Oh, sorry. They also established the Schengen Agreement to allow for the free movement, visa-free movement of European citizens to be able to work anywhere throughout Europe. And, of course, that was used against the Europeans. You know, once the Rothschilds decided to destroy Europe, they then brought in immigrants who are hostile to the European culture, and then they allowed them to have visa-free movement around Europe, you know, to create havoc throughout the European countries.
I can see why we got interference in our communications. The more you talk, the more I see it, because you're providing substance for what I am discovering in present time. And you're exactly right. I made a note here of something I wanted to ask you, and I can't read my own writing, but I wanted to ask you about the European Journal. Okay, can you talk a little bit about that? You said you had some experience with that.
Sure. I founded the European Review, which again became the departmental publication for the Center for European Studies at Essex, and I was interested in receiving both the pros and cons from the European elite on why they both supported the creation of the European Union and why they opposed it. So I requested manuscripts and statements from the elite, and I was very surprised to see that they were more than willing to provide those statements. And so from there, I think I was able to acquire, you know, a sense of why they were, you know, why they were trying to, you know, create the EU.
Interesting. I want to be honest without being insulting. When I look at your biography here and I'm hearing you talk about the work you were involved in, to me, I get the feeling with you, they were training a future globalist. Would that be a correct assumption? And then you had a mid-course correction?
I think that is correct. And I went to Essex University, I think with that credential. I guess I was trained to assume my role, you know, in a think tank or within the government or the media. And I think they were trying to condition me to think in such a way that I would automatically support globalism. But then having said that, I was sabotaged early on. for example, I took the State Department Civil Service exam after I graduated from Essex. And, of course, the university taught to the Foreign Service exam. So, unsurprisingly, I was one of the top performers. I was among the top 100 of over maybe 10,000 applicants for that year. But yet I was given a failing score. And I wasn't told why I had failed for about 8 years onward. And at that point, they said, actually, you know, you had passed, but we gave your score to somebody else. So they had their own people whom they wanted to place in the positions of power. I also was offered a job at CBS News in London after I graduated, but the Home Office would never process my visa. In fact, they continued to misplace the visa many, many times, resulting in my having to travel to Los Angeles and back to London on several expensive trips until I finally gave up and returned to the United States. So there was interference, and I was, you know, attempting to, you know, work in journalism or, you know, work in some level in diplomacy around the time that the Clintons were selling us out to communist China. So I think they wanted, you know, their own maybe intelligence assets or those who they knew would be reliable agents, you know, to hold those positions.
What was it about you that triggered their disdain?
I think it could have been one recommendation from Alan Lee Williams. He said she has honest character, or she's a person with integrity. I wonder if that was the kiss of death.
You can't be bent.
Correct. I could not. I would not bend to a corrupt agenda.
You know, it's interesting. I had the same appraisal made on me. It's really interesting, almost word for word. I was told you could go much farther in what we're doing, and you could stop being an errand boy if you were just a little more flexible in your worldview. That's what I was told personally.
Flexible.
Yeah, and that's pretty much what you're hearing behind the scenes. And Alan Lee Williams was the man who was running the Atlantic Council, right?
Yes, he was a member of the Trilateral Commission. I think he may have been a chairman of the European Speaking Union, and he was also the director of Toynbee Hall, which is
so,
a Fabian society.
Oh, no. Oh, I just want to say it ain't so. Okay, I went right to Fabian socialism, and if I'm wrong, correct me. But being an old sociology instructor is one of the things I've taught. Fabian socialism is one of the five pillars of sociology. And it basically says if you don't put more into the state than you take out, you should be done away with. And I'm paraphrasing, but that's essentially what it means. Is this the same kind of Fabian we're talking about?
I believe that the elites do hold that view. Alan personally was a great humanitarian, believe it or not. I mean, he did care about the downtrodden. My impression of Fabian socialism at the time was that the corporate classes wanted to remove employee benefits off their ledgers. And so they would reach out to the state to cover health care and other, you know, other employee benefits to ensure that they could enhance their profits. And then once those people were placed onto the welfare rolls, they would have to then scale back the money that they paid them to retain more of the public funds for themselves. But I think if you are a useless eater, you don't contribute as much as you take out, that they don't want you to be, you know, they might, I don't know if they would do away with you, but I think that they would consider you to be not of value.
Herbert Spencer is often credited with being the founder of this movement, at least in your intro to sociology textbooks. And I saw a video of him, actually a film of him made before his death, in his very elderly years, and he used that exact phrase, that if you don't contribute more than you take out, the state should do away with you. That was his view. And I see that view being present in our leadership today. We have to hold it here just for a second. We have to take this break, or my sponsors are going to be screaming at me. But ladies and gentlemen, we were doing some personal shopping the other day, and we're in Fry's department store here in the Phoenix area. Now, we know we live north of Phoenix, but we have to drive into the city to shop. And they were out of hamburger. And a couple months earlier, they were out of milk. And this is a very large store. And we're seeing shortages all over the place. And the you know, Bob Griswold and I just did a TV show on the supply chain. Graphic. We put illustrations up, maps up. We showed the whole nine yards about what's coming and what's already beginning to happen. And try to get your jeans and T-shirts now, folks, because there's now shortages there. But the shortage is most critical is in food. And that's why we're offering storable food. And I don't want anything to do with World Economic Forum dieting, which is aquatics, plant, bugs, and fake lab meat. I don't want anything to do with that. And until this storm blows over and we can defeat these people, hopefully, I'm getting into storable food. You should get into storable food. Restaurant quality is what we have. It's not organic by any means. We're not saying it is, but it's diverse. It's a well-balanced diet, 2,000 calories per day, which is even more than I consume, and I work out every day. And so you have your choice here to stay stocked or not. 25-year shelf life. And $100 off the three-month emergency package is what they call it. And you say, well, Dave, I want to buy a year or 2 years. Well, just buy all emergency packages, and you'll save the $100 all the way through. So go to preparewithdave.com. And I can't stress this strongly enough, folks. I do not trust this administration in a crisis to feed the people. They left 1,000 Americans behind, plus allies, behind enemy lines. And we know that's true from the sat phone calls that are coming out of Afghanistan. And I was actually allowed to listen to a sat phone call in real time that was not in the media. So I know this is real. So preparewithdave.com. Don't put your trust in anybody else but yourself right now and perhaps the Lord. Secondly, I'm concerned about communication. I know for a fact that if we go into uprising, there's talk right now of secession. I just watched Tim Pool's show this morning where he talked about secession. And New Hampshire has a movement. Texas has a movement. There are 14 movements in the United States right now. Listen, if we go into rebellion, it's continuity of government protocols to encircle a city, shut it off, turn off the power, stop all the shipments into the city, starve them into submission, no one in, no one out. And they could accomplish the lockdown of a city in 30 minutes. It's been practiced. So what are you going to do for communication? Sat phones. Not everybody is going to be up to date on, well, your CB and your shortwave and all this. Those are okay. Those are effective. But sat phones are much harder to interfere with, and this is why we represent the satellite phone store. I don't want to be in a position where I can't communicate with my family in a crisis. And you can find out more. And by the way, it's not expensive. I pay 1/4 the cost for my sat phone that I do my cell phone bill. So you can call 855-980-5830. That's 855-980-5830. I know the people there. They're good people. They do not push, and they're just going to give you the facts. And one more thing, since we're combining our ads together all in one segment here, because I don't want to take away from this content that's so important. But if we go into what I think we're going to go into, we can't absorb $40 trillion of debt, and that's about what we're ready to jump into. And plus, the nations of the world are jumping away from the petrodollar, and that's our only backing for the dollar. We haven't been on gold since the 70s and really effectively since the Great Depression. So what was our backing? The petrodollar. Thank you, Bretton Woods. But that's disappearing, folks, and we're acquiring tremendous debt. That's a formula for hyperinflation. And when we hyperinflate, you're not going to be buying any prepping goods. You're not going to be buying much of anything. And what I'm saying is you need to prep your resources to survive what's coming. You won't be bulletproof. Everyone's going to take their hits with what's coming. But you can minimize the damage, and Noble Gold specializes in that. And I am their customer. I used to just be an advertiser for 3 years, and then I said, they do good work here. I need to get involved with them. And I'm really happy I did. If you want a chance to come out the other side of the crisis they're getting ready to put us into, and I believe it's intentional, you need to start bulletproofing your assets as best you can. And they have plans for about everything. So I'm going to give you a number to call. It's really, really easy to talk to them. And they are trained not to close a deal on you. You have to close the deal yourself. They'll send you free info. They'll give you advice. They're great people. And they know what they're doing. 877-646-5347. 877-646-5347. The good people at Noble Gold. Well, that takes care of our ads for the entire segment here. I thought I better combine them because I'm having a hard time breaking away from this content. Not only because it hits close to home for my background, but also too because it hits close to home for what's coming. And Susan, when you look at the most... Well, I want to ask you this, too. But I want to finish the thought on CBS News. If I understood you correctly, you did go to work for CBS News at some point, right?
Yes, I did. I worked as an intern at CBS News in Los Angeles, and I also was a news writer for CBS News Radio, KNX News. And the assistant bureau chief of Los Angeles became the bureau chief of London for the CBS bureau in London. So he had remembered me, and we had a good relationship back in Los Angeles, and he was happy to offer me a job after I graduated.
How long did you do that for?
I was unable to accept the job in London because my visa was never processed.
Boy, that's interesting, too. What an effective way to block you from doing something.
It was very interesting. The Guardian published a few years ago that the Clintons were involved in visa diplomacy. So they weighed in on who got the visas and who didn't. So I think that may have had something to do with it.
Why wouldn't the Clintons like you?
I think at that time, the Clintons were falling under scrutiny for essentially selling seats to communist Chinese on the Commerce Department. They were also selling weapons to communist China. So there were charges of treason being brought by Admiral Orr. And the Lewinsky scandal was actually used as a diversion from those charges so that Bill Clinton would be impeached over sex with an intern as opposed to treason. The Lewinsky scandal was, of course, pushed by Tom DeLay, who worked with the Clintons to help China join the World Trade Organization.
Who was the admiral again?
Thomas Moore.
I didn't understand the last name.
Moore, M-O-O-R-E-R.
Oh, okay. Thomas Moore. All right. And he was aware of selling commerce seats to communist China?
Yes, and I believe the communist Chinese were among the biggest contributors to the Clintons, both their presidential campaign, the Clinton-Gore presidential campaign, and then their reelection campaign. And so they were, the Clintons had given the Chinese our nuclear secrets. They had, eliminated our strategic advantage over the Chinese. I believe that they had also granted the Chinese control over parts of Panama, which would, again, neutralize our military. And they were selling seats, I believe, on like trade missions and related seats also within the Commerce Department to the communist Chinese, and were allowing them access to the higher echelons of our military.
My goodness. This was, if I remember correctly, and I may get the missile wrong, but the DNC and Al Gore selling technology for campaign donations to Communist China for the Silkworm missile. I may have a few of the details wrong, but I think I have the general idea. Do you know about this?
Yes, that they facilitated meetings with President Clinton in exchange for campaign contributions.
Oh,
these would be meetings with the communist Chinese.
This is... I can see how Sarah saw how our knowledge would blend. When we look at... It's my contention that the Chinese contamination, even down to our local government now, is so insidious that we can't possibly control our internal affairs right now. We have too many people on the take, one way or the other. Either they're getting directly bribed in offshore stock dealings, and I know about that with some of our public officials in Arizona, or they have business relationships they don't want to tamper with. So they do just what the Chinese want. And you're talking about a genesis of this and an explosion of this in Clinton. I would imagine this started earlier than Clinton, though, didn't it?
Yes, it did. It goes all the way back to Henry Kissinger, and I think he was the chief driver of this agenda. Now, Henry Kissinger was recruited to work on intelligence and counterintelligence as a Jewish refugee in Germany, and he was recruited to the OSS by Wild Bill Donovan, who had interest within the Rockefeller Bank. And he had established the Office of Strategic Services, which was the precursor to the CIA, and based upon the British Secret Service model. So Henry Kissinger was recruited from the very beginning to advance this wider China agenda. He was mentored in England, in London, by a prime minister who wanted to open up the West to communist China. The prime minister, of course, had a relationship with Bertrand Russell, a socialist who had groomed Chairman Mao and had trained him and indoctrinated him. Mao Zedong led the communist revolution and was also a Rothschild bloodline. Kissinger was then placed within the Nixon administration as Secretary of State.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Nixon opened up the West to China, normalized relationships with China, in concert with George Herbert Walker Bush, who was the de facto ambassador to Taiwan and also the director of the liaison office with communist China, and his administration was stacked with intelligence officials from the OSS and from the Harriman law firm, Harriman financial firm, Brown Brothers Harriman. And of course, the Harriman firm started off working in textiles. With textiles, of course, you have the merchants who stem back centuries, who had made their riches working with China, which was not communist at the time, but through the sale of silks and other materials. So they had a relationship with China and had intended to tap the markets of Central Asia, and eventually lead the New World Order from Asia. So Kissinger was one of the leading drivers of this agenda. His assistant, Winston Lord, ended up working as ambassador to China for Reagan and Bush, and then was Undersecretary of State for Pacific Affairs under the Clinton administration, ensuring that the agenda continued regardless of who was in charge who was actually running the administration. Kissinger had also established a group called the National Committee for U.S.-China Relations, which opened up, which actually promoted opening up communist China among the intelligentsia, the media, corporate executives, and they had worked on a campaign spanning decades and were eventually able to get access to the high levels of media, government. Their office opened at the UN Center with funding from the Rockefellers. The Rockefellers, in turn, were able to bring hundreds of corporate executives together in Canada, where through meetings facilitated by Prime Minister Trudeau, who is the father of the current Prime Minister, to figure out ways working with Communist China on how they could tap the market. This was done within Canada, coordinated by Rockefeller, who controlled our multinationals through interlocking boards of directors. And of course, Kissinger.
What year
was trained,
that? Can you give me a
that
year?
That was in the early 1970s. And then Kissinger worked across the diplomatic aisle with Mao Zedong in concert with the CIA agents, former OSS officials, and they plotted together how they could weaken the United States from within, and eventually pave the way for communist conquest of the United States.
Yeah, we're reading. We're watching the movie today of the final chapter. It's interesting. One of my wake-up books that I read, and I talked about this often. I'm now friends with him. It's kind of funny. I used to admire the guy. Now we're friends. But Pat Wood, who lives in the Phoenix area as well, and we've done some concerts, some conferences together. And he wrote a book with the late Anthony Sutton, a professor, and the book was entitled Trilaterals Over Washington, published in the late 70s. And it was really talking about something that was in denial. No one wanted to believe there was a trilateral commission. In fact, when I read the book, Susan, this is before the internet, I went to, I was living in Colorado Springs at the time, and I went to the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs, and used their electronic library. They used to link electronically to their all their campuses in the state. And I looked up Trilateral Commission, and I only found one story that was written in 1977 by the Atlantic Monthly, and it was debunking the conspiracy notions of the trilaterals. But what Pat said in his book ties right into what you just said. He said the way the Rockefellers, and he looked at it as more of a Rockefeller centralized agenda, because that's what he saw in his research.
Correct.
And he said that the way that they controlled the American corporations and they could therefore influence the government and control the people better was through interlocking boards of directorate.
Correct.
And that got around the Sherman Antitrust Act and the Clayton Antitrust Act and all those supposed prohibitions.
That is correct. And they also used those corporations to bankroll the Bolshevik Revolution and the Chinese Communist Revolution. I think Anthony Sutton had also documented that
mm-hmm.
as well.
Wow. Well, I know Pat Wood really well. This is and now he's kind of like the guru if you want to know anything about technocracy. And this is kind of the outgrowth of this, I think, using corporate technology to basically subdue the population. Well, when we look at these plans that go back as far as, the Nixon years, I want to ask you something, though, before I get into this next part.
Sure.
Why Watergate? Do you have any notion why? Because Watergate was obviously an orchestrated plot to remove Nixon, in my opinion.
Why Watergate? To be honest with you, I don't know. I know that there were some recent revelations alleging that Watergate was intended to cover up a pedophile ring in Washington, D.C., but I don't know why they were targeting Nixon specifically. I think that he might have been a little bit skeptical to the Rothschild / Rockefeller agenda, a bit resistant to it, but I really don't know why they targeted him, to be honest.
I've been told this, and this is by a former very high-ranking military source that I know well. And it was his considered opinion, and I don't want to say opinion, but he was in position to see the workings going on. Nixon was scaling down Vietnam. And this wasn't really a happy topic with all the globalists because they wanted the military-industrial complex to continue to realize great profits, but even bigger than that was the heroin trafficking coming out of the Golden Triangle that was influenced by the war coming out of these areas, and they wanted to continue to use military influence to keep these trade routes open to supply heroin to the world, kind of like the first Afghanistan of its type, where you're misusing military assets to protect drug shipments. Does that fit with anything you've ever heard or seen?
I know that the Nixon tried to scale back LBJ's war on poverty. So I think LBJ had given a deluge of public funds for social services, a large portion of that money going into private pockets. And I know that he actually expanded the military-industrial complex. During his administration, a large pool of oil was discovered in Alaska, and I think in Proudhon Bay. And Nixon made sure, or Kissinger rather, made sure that oil was not developed so that America would be forced to be dependent upon oil from Saudi Arabia and other countries. The oil was then concentrated within Alaska. There was a settlement that was arranged to ensure that the land rights were claimed properly and that the natives who lived, Native Americans, Eskimos, who resided on that land were given settlements. The settlements were used to create Alaskan Native corporations, and those became a boondoggle for the military-industrial complex. They were billed as a way to provide some type of economic equity for the Native Americans, but were actually front organizations for the military-industrial complex, like McDonnell Douglas, Halliburton, and these large corporations.
It does really fit. That's really, really interesting. Yeah, I've never believed the Watergate story on its surface, because I look at this current administration right now. Watergate is, if you were going K through 12 on serious conspiracies, Watergate's in kindergarten compared to what Biden's doing now.
I think what Watergate demonstrates is that at that time, the Rockefellers and their allies were able to use the arms of the government and the media as a weapon against those political officials who are not towing the line.
And we see that today, too, in a big way. I mean, Biden said it all. If you don't take the jab and the governors get in the way, we'll run over the governors.
Correct.
And that's, it's out in the open now. I mean, it's not even covert. It's not subterfuge. It's open policy now. It's declared. And it's absolutely crazy. You see, this is, saying this to the audience now, this is what Susan brings here. I mean, you can see how she touches into the areas that we talk about in the present. But we're getting the real history of this. And what you've helped me see, just in this short interview, is how extensive the Chinese influence has been and for how long. And that's the amazing thing. For how long is the key. I wanted to ask you a question before we close. Dick McConnell's wife, former Secretary of Treasury Chow, mommy and daddy mm-hmm. have a big communist Chinese shipping firm. They control a lot of the ports in China. At least I hear they have controlling interest. Is that part of this plot too? Because she should never have been vetted for her position.
I agree with that. Now, I haven't looked into her activities specifically. I do have some concerns about whether, to the lengths to which Donald Trump was in fact working on behalf of the Patriots. There are a lot of indications that he may have been compromised both through his the loans that he took out for his casino interests from the Rothschilds. Also, I think at one point, Ivanka Trump had attempted to establish a Trump Tower in the Republic of Azerbaijan overlooking the Caspian Sea. And, of course, the Rothschilds controlled the oil interests within the Caspian Sea. Ivanka had intended to use the tower to entertain the oligarchs of the world, while they're to enable them to cut deals and so forth. So I think Donald Trump has a lot of financial interest throughout the world. My hope is that he was he had greater concern and consideration for the American people than he did for his own portfolio. But I don't think that that Mrs. Chow should have been in the Trump administration. And there were many who should not have been.
Oh yeah, no, that's one of the more glaring examples on because of helping us understand what went wrong today. And you mentioned Ivanka Trump, husband Jared Kushner, who has a $5 billion debt to George Soros. And I know that for
that
a fact.
Speaks volumes.
Well, some of the. I guess what I'm saying here is when you got Jared Kushner involved and Trump should have 86'd both of them from the White House for the stuff they were involved in. And Jared Kushner's deep ties to George Soros, who is as anti-American as they come. I share your concerns when you talk about Trump, but I also tend to give him the benefit of the doubt and say, I think he had a change of heart when he was president, and I'll tell you why. He did away with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which would have established corporate rule over America. Whether I think there are 22-man council that could have vetoed anything the government could have done. And if he was truly a globalist, he wouldn't have done that on his first action.
I agree. And he also tried to resist the Green New Deal, and he made extensive efforts to ensure that we remained energy independent.
Yeah, exactly. Everything that that Kissinger and Nixon and all these people tried to block. You've written some books, right?
I have. I think the most.
We have about 40 seconds left, and what I want to do is give you an opportunity to tell people how they can start picking up your books. We're going to continue this as a series of interviews, people. And Susan, we have a lot more than the four that we planned on, believe me. this could end up being a series. But anyway, how do people find you and get a hold of your books?
Thank you. You can find me on my webpage, which is www.susanbradford.org. And you can, my background information and my contact information, along with information on my books, is included there. And I think, just for the purposes of interest to your audience, the most important books that that will help you understand what we're facing with regards to China include A Shadow Dragon, which reveals how our political establishment sold us out to communist China, Royal Blood Lies, which reveals how the Rothschilds essentially took over the British monarchy and governments throughout the world, and my most recent book, Carter Treachery, which reveals how this agenda traces to Central Asia going back centuries, even preceding the establishment of the United States. So it's a centuries-old agenda.
Okay. And on that note, Susan, we're up against a hard break, and I'm sorry about that, but I'll be in touch. We're going to definitely schedule some follow-ups. This was very enlightening. Thank you very much. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining
us. Thank you so much.